Joining me now from our crisis response team here in Florence is Lori Severance. And Lori, when I asked you to come in, I didn't know what was unfolding in the community as far as this recent catastrophe or recent horrible thing that happened with a Sisa High School student. Mm-hmm. But there was a suicide last week, and Sisa News covered it pretty extensively on Saturday. And I don't want to get into any details about this, except for the fact that I want to get into, you know, how big of a crisis is this in our community, and how has COVID, if at all, affected what's happening with this? Do you have any insight into the effects of the COVID aspect of it?
I think COVID's made it much more difficult on everyone of all ages, but particularly kids, because their primary support group and what they're drawn towards in terms of decision making and just kind of their development at that age is their social, their peer group. And they have not been in contact with their social group this past year. There's been a lot of isolation. Kids have not been in school. A lot of kids have, you know, they have not been out socializing and just doing the kinds of things they do, skateboarding and going to the movies. All those things are shut down. So I think the isolation, it's affected everybody. I think it has affected depression rates and probably as a result of that, suicide rates. Florence has always had a very high suicide rate, which is pretty alarming. But I do think COVID plays a part in this, definitely.
When I look back over my lifetime at suicide, it doesn't seem like much has changed in the sense that you very rarely see it coming. Mm-hmm. I mean, most True. People, when you hear about it, they say, oh, I had no idea, or I wouldn't have suspected that.
True.
So that aspect of it hasn't changed. So in part, I don't want to necessarily blame the way we as parents bring up our kids. But yet with each generation, it seems like we have gotten farther and farther away from those skills at raising kids or recognizing things from a social aspect or from a family aspect. And that some parents today, younger parents especially, don't have the same toolkit that some of the older parents have. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, that may be true. And, you know, again, it's a case-by-case basis. A lot of times there's a lot of other family factors or personal factors going into. It's never one thing that drives someone to end their life. There could be a lot of other family stressors going on as well, or school stressors, or, you know, just depression, anxiety, mental health kinds of issues. But I think people in general are busier this generation. I think people are very caught up with work and, you know, just multiple money issues and multiple stressors, and to a point where maybe they're paying a little less attention. It's also kind of a generation of everyone focuses on themselves, as opposed to, I think, when we were growing up, it was much more of a people take care of each other and look out for each other. But in terms of not seeing it coming, that's always been a very common factor with suicide. People don't let you know. You have the instances where people make multiple cries for help and maybe make suicidal gestures, and it's a cry for help. But people who truly are in a place where they're contemplating ending their life give very few clues. A lot of times in retrospect, you can look back and say, oh my gosh, I missed this. But it's you don't really miss it. It's you don't see the whole picture until that final piece is in the puzzle and you realize where their head was out all along.
Talk about a little bit, if you can, about that, the idea that, you know, a lot of times we'll think people are getting better, mm-hmm. you know, right before an event like this, and what kind of what we were unprepared for when we see someone getting right. better.
you'll often hear people say, I thought they were doing better. I thought they just seemed recently like they were doing much better. And what the literature kind of shows is that people sometimes are so depressed and so immobilized by their depression that they don't really have the energy to organize a plan to actually end their life. When they've made that plan, when they finally have decided this is what I am going to do, it's in a sense a relief for them. There's finally an end to their suffering. They see an end in sight. And so sometimes they will seem like they're doing better. They're a little bit more upbeat and they're talking about the future and doing some of the things that were so alarming before that, you know, that they weren't doing before. And again, in retrospect, sometimes what we find out is that is because they made a decision and they were going to go through with it, and they did. And that causes a lot of guilt with family members. But, you know, until you have that final piece, that final horrible piece of the puzzle, all those other little signs were just that. They were little concerning episodes that didn't necessarily lead you to believe that someone is in that acute of danger.
And there are a lot of people who deal with depression
yes.
that never get to that point.
Exactly.
That never you know, say, okay, I'm done.
Exactly.
Here's my decision. So there's not a real thought of in a regular day-to-day basis, oh, I saw that coming.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I don't know what the current data is on things like, you know, video games and things like that. But I do know a couple of people that I am directly familiar with that spend a lot of time in a closed room, the shades down, the lights off, sitting in front of a video game where their only contact with the outside world is the people they're on the game with.
Right.
That doesn't sound like it'd be too healthy. Is that?
You know,
do we know?
I don't know statistically. I think a lot of the research says that that's not healthy. That's clearly a bias of our generation, too, where we made contact with real people. I mean, that was an issue with my son, too. I hated the fact that he would be on video games and his only contact was on the headphones with the game. And yet he used to always say, Mom, I am with my friends. It's a different kind of contact. I can't see where it's healthy either. And, you know, that's my bias. I mm-hmm. don't know that the research supports that. But I certainly think it maybe desensitizes kids, too. When you're in actual social interaction with each other, you look out for each other and you're more in tune with what's happening in someone else's life. When it's all over a headphones, it's all second, third hand. It's all kind of like watching a TV screen. So I do think it causes some emotional distance between kids, between people that maybe we didn't have in our generation. And not just kids. There's a lot of not even young adult men in their 40s and so that are addicted to these video games. It's what they go home. That's how they relax after work, is to play hours of video games.
And not you know, like meeting out certain periods of time, say, mm-hmm. well, okay, I'll do it for this period of time,
right.
and then I'll break away from it. And I got to believe, you probably know this more thing, the world has gone so strange over time, and everyone's, I mean, you know, they're afraid of shaking hands. They're afraid of hugging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes, you know, we hear about, well, you know, this congressman or the president or somebody hugs somebody at a meeting. And then next thing you know, this person's saying they felt uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And yet those things are so essential to human interaction.
Yes.
And yet we've kind of taken that away, you know, out yes. of society. I mean, that must play a part. Too, yeah. and not being able to have that physical interaction.
Absolutely. And COVID makes us afraid to hug each other. Yes, the politics of what comes out of that sometimes. We've just become a more distant culture, emotionally as well as physically. And, you know, again, I don't know if that's a personal bias, but I can't see where that's healthy. I really can't. We are a social animal. We just are.
Is there, when you get in a situation where you're having to deal with someone who's taken their own life, obviously, like you said, there's guilt with the family that remains behind. Sometimes there's anger, mm-hmm. You know, because this they say that suicide is a very selfish act. But when you get into a situation and you want to go into a counseling situation with people who might have seen this, because we've seen through, especially where, say, stars are concerned, we had an issue a couple of years ago where a person in a band committed suicide, and that gave someone else, you know, the ability to do that in another band. And so it was sort of like almost like a domino effect there. What do you do when you get into an environment and you talk to people about, you know, recognizing the warning signs?
Well, I think one big myth is that if I bring it up with them, if I ask them if they're thinking of harming or killing themselves, that it will put the idea in their head. And that is absolutely not true. If the idea is already there, usually the person's relieved to finally have someone recognize it and take that taboo away from it and be able to talk about it. And it might save someone's life. If the thought is not in their head, you're not going to put it there. It's for most of us, it's not an option. It just is not going to be an option. So I think asking the question is really important. There's a lot of healing in people who have lost someone to suicide to come together and talk about that, because it is still seen as such a taboo way to die. And not only does family often blame themselves because they feel like maybe they missed these signs and they'll never know the reason why. It's always going to be kind of not put to rest. But sometimes you have people who, you know, friends and loved ones, people who mean well, saying very insensitive things, you know, unknowingly. But, you know, why would he do that? Did you see it coming? You know, oh, my gosh, what happened? It's all those subtle little comments that feel like blame, even more blame, especially to a parent or a spouse or someone who's very close to that person and already feels like maybe they should have seen it coming, which is a very irrational thought. That's, you know, we talk about that in the suicide loss support group. That's very unwarranted guilt, but it's part of the nature of having a loss like this.
Does the idea that when someone hears someone else talking about it go, wow, I didn't know that somebody else was feeling this way too, at that moment, is that a helpful realization for a lot of people to come to?
I think it is. I mean, I think it is. First of all, they want to be able to talk about their loved one. Part of the distance they feel from other people who haven't had this kind of loss is that people shy away from it and stop mentioning the person like they never existed. They want to talk about them. But I think anything supportive and empathetic, like, wow, you know, I didn't know he was that depressed. You must not have seen anything coming. I mean, that don't lay blame. And it's a very subtle thing. So you have to kind of word things carefully. It's very easy for family members to take on more guilt or blame or feel like they're being blamed by others. So I think, yeah, just saying this must be horrible. This must be just, you know, how can I help? How can I be there for you?
Compassion, yeah. Empathy.
I loved him too. You know, let's talk about him. What, you know, just allowing them to talk about the loved one and not question why they did it, because nobody knows why they did it. You know, to ask, what do you think happened, or why did he, or, you know, what, you know, those questions are not helpful at all.
When this happens in a school setting, a lot of times, you know, the staff and the faculty will get groups together, they'll get counselors together, you know, and sort of, you know, invite people if they want to have some counseling. Some students will never take advantage of that. Is that necessarily a bad thing, or is it just people dealing with it differently?
I think everyone does deal with it differently, and everyone deals with it in their own time. Sometimes people want to seek counseling right away, and other people don't deal with it for years and may come forward years later and say, okay, this is still there for me and I need to to talk to someone about it. So I think it's important to let people do it in their own time. But I think it's also important to just, you know, as parents, if we're talking about kids here, that you ask the questions. You know, did you know him? You know, was he in any of your classes? You know, what do you think about this? What's going on in your head around this? Because with kids, there's that sense of, you know, you're going to live forever at that point. And to have a death of someone your age in such a violent, you know, drastic, sudden way like that, it really impacts kids. It really does. As does a car accident. I mean, they just at that age don't see their lives ending anytime soon. So it's a huge impact emotionally on kids to lose a classmate in any kind of sudden, unexpected, violent way like that.
And I guess it's like you said, everybody deals with it differently. So there might be a child or a person that knew this person who's not overly affected by it, and yet somebody else didn't know them at all and might be extremely affected
Absolutely.
By it. So you don't really...
Absolutely. And because there's also other factors. I mean, the person who didn't know them and is affected may have had an uncle that died by suicide, you know, or just even a sudden death in the family by natural causes. And death is a kind of up close and personal issue right then. Everyone deals with it differently. And there's background issues in everyone's life that add to how someone responds to any one incident.
What are some of the resources available? I know you said that we've had a high rate of suicide here in Florence. But what, other than the crisis response team, are there any other groups that advocate for people that have been through this?
I don't know of specific groups with suicide. You know, we have the one at the fire station on Monday evenings for someone who's lost a loved one to suicide. But there's general counselors that are really good. And for some people, group is not the answer. I mean, this kind of loss, sometimes it's really good for people to get together because it is such a taboo subject. And so other people who have experienced this type of loss, there's a real bonding and connection and support there that they may not find in a general bereavement group with people who've lost someone through cancer or other means. But some people do better in individual counseling, and they just want to talk to someone one-on-one. We've got some excellent therapists, individual therapists here in town. Options is a great counseling agency, too. I know I don't know if they have a wait list right now. Sometimes they've got a bit of a wait list, but that's a great resource as well. And there's a lot of online resources, both for teen suicide and adult suicide. I mean, if you just Google suicide support groups or information, there's all kinds of national and state level organizations that have, you know, online chats if you aren't comfortable in a group setting in person. They've got different, you know, writing where you can kind of write in poems and writings in memory of your person, and people kind of exchange information. There's all kinds of things online for people who aren't comfortable in person.
Let's switch gears a little bit now, because I wanted to talk about, you know, how this last year and COVID-19 has affected people, and also how the crisis response team has been engaged with different things going on in the community. Like, for example, there's the homeless population is growing a bit in town. I don't know if you guys ever get calls out on that or how to deal with that. And some of it, you know, people have become homeless because of what's happened this past year. What are you seeing as far as that goes and responses that you've had to go to for that?
You know, the biggest impact I'm seeing on the homeless, twofold. One, the difficulty of getting them vaccinated and educating them about whether or not they want to be vaccinated, but getting them to a site as well. To be able to be vaccinated. And the other thing is the shelters are not able to open in the way that they usually do because of social distancing. Reverend Wood at the Presbyterian Church here has been wonderful. He has set up I think a lot of people in town know those individual pallets for people to come in at night. But it's been very difficult on the homeless because they're not able to go to the shelters and the usual resources, the food banks and the kinds of things that they usually utilize and need just to kind of get by in their daily life.
And two, it's probably been, I know in some settings, I mean, I'm lucky. My wife and I have been home so much, but it seems to be better and better the more we do it. But some people don't have that benefit. Some people have the opposite effect.
Right.
And how has that meted out over the past year?
And you're talking about homeless people?
Not homeless now. Let's go to homed people that may have had to stay at home with each other and have had difficulties dealing with that situation. Because a lot of times, you know, people are okay when they're just spending a couple hours together at night.
Yeah.
But then when they're spending every day together, it's a little different.
There has been quite an uptick. Bob Teeter at SOS has talked about the incredible increase in domestic violence calls that they've had, sexual assault calls. I'm sure there's an uptick in child abuse, all those kinds of things, because all the stressors that we all deal with but have outside ways to kind of release some of that stress, all of that stress is now being held at home. People aren't able to go to the gym. A lot of people aren't able to go to work, or they don't have the income of work. Kids are at home all day long. They're stressed and hyper and you know, kind of climbing the walls.
And the weather is, you know, sometimes keeps us from getting outside too.
Which is weather's been horrible. So, all those family stressors and daily stressors that we all work through on a regular basis without a lot of struggle are intensified, definitely intensified when we're stuck in the same four walls with the same people all day, every day, for a year. It's been a ridiculous amount of time.
Yeah.
Yes.
How many people are in your volunteer group? How many?
We just hired two new people. We have eight. We have eight crisis responders right now.
Some are paid, some are volunteers, or they're all paid?
They're all paid. Okay. They're all paid. There's a stipend for each shift that you pull, whether you get called out or not, and then there's an hourly rate for when they go out on calls. So,
And what kind of training do they go through?
They have to get their peer support specialist certification through Oregon Health Authority, and that's a 40-hour class they have to go to, and then there's a couple other little online classes they have to take and then send in for their certification, and of course a background check and DMV check and all of that. We do a 24-hour training at the fire department, just orienting them to the program in general and talking about basic counseling skills, suicide assessment, crisis intervention, those kinds of things. And then we have, you know, of course, they do ride-alongs for a period of time while they learn the skills and see what we do in different situations. But we have ongoing training. We've got a full-day quarterly training, and Lane County, the contract for this program has been very generous with the training budget. So if people find outside trainings, I'm sending them to those all the time. So they've got pretty extensive training in suicide assessment and intervention, crisis intervention, mental health assessments, drug and alcohol and mental health presentations, kind of what they're looking at there, death notifications, lots of things, basic counseling skills, trauma-informed care. We keep adding to the list, but we're constantly training, doing trainings.
I know that I talked with Matt House at Western Lane, and I know it's a little different aspect of it, but he says their calls are up, you know, more than twice. I think a couple of years ago it was 1,200. They had 4,000, I think, this last year. I guess you're seeing probably more calls because of COVID the last year?
We are. The last couple months, surprisingly, the calls have gone back down. But November, December, January were absolutely crazy out there. Yeah, absolutely.
Lori Severance, thank you so much for stopping in today. It's always good to talk with you and to get a sense of what's, you know, what's available out there and where people can turn to. And obviously they can, you know, call the non-emergency number with the police and they can have a group come out if they are experiencing problems.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. We're there 24/7.
So. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. Bye-bye.
Coming up next, Jake Thompson sits down with Wayne Sharp. Talks about baseball on this edition of Our Town.